It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Lindsey Graham is getting a new phone number after Donald Trump gave it out to an audience in Graham's home state of South Carolina yesterday. It's our weekly look at the latest and strangest in national politics.
First, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals reinstated Milwaukee's residency rule yesterday, requiring city workers like teachers and police officers to live in the city of Milwaukee.
The original law had been on the books for about 75 years. A provision in the 2013 to 2015 state budget invalidated that requirement. After back and forth legal battles in the last few years, the law will now be reinstated, something our next guest says is good for Milwaukee.
James Causey is a blogger and columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he's on the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel editorial board. James, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, you say in your recent opinion piece that you believe and have always felt that city jobs are for city residents. How come?
It just gets down to this. When I think about building a middle class really starts with these really good city jobs. And if we lose that by having these people not live in the city that they serve, it cripples the middle class. And I live in the heart of the central city. And I know what, and I've always lived in a central city, so I know what it looks like. I know what it feels like. I remember when we had these vibrant factory jobs and how the family structure was stronger back then. And when we start to see our erosion of our middle class sector and our middle class jobs, that's when we start to have a lot of the problems that we have in the city today. So I think people want to have it both ways. They want to say, okay, we want the jobs, but we want to live outside Milwaukee. But those same people will criticize the city for saying, well, what's wrong? How come you don't have a strong and vibrant middle class?
Now, as you understand it, why did the appeals court reinstate this?
It's a good question. I'm just happy that they did. I still think that this is going to be a long legal battle. I don't think it's over yet. But what I hope for is that the mayor and will continue to make a strong argument for us to do this, because he's been one of the proponents saying that if we lose these if people work in the city and live outside the city, it'll turn our city into another Detroit. I don't know how true that is, but if you look at what happened to Detroit with all its problems, one of the things that they did was they left a residency requirement, and then it really went downhill fast.
Now, for those people who are in favor of relaxing, getting rid of that residency requirement, one of the arguments they make is that you don't have enough people within the city of Milwaukee to fill these city jobs. What do you say to that?
Well, I know a lot of people that are out of work who are looking for work, so I don't know how true that really is. And I don't know. That's one of those kind of things that I really don't believe in. I think the only positions where we did have a lot of problems filling those jobs were teacher jobs. But as far as police officers, fire, I don't see that as a problem. I think they actually have a waiting list for people to get on, people who live right here in the city. So I don't really believe that.
Now, from the people that you speak to, do you think there is broad support for this residency requirement, or do you think that there are people within the ranks of teachers, police officers, who would like to live somewhere else but work in the city?
Well, it's mixed. It depends on who you talk to. I mean, there are some people who say, as far as teachers are concerned, it doesn't make a difference if a teacher lives in the city or lives outside the city. A teacher job is to teach children. But I use the example that I knew dear to my heart. My fourth grade teacher, when I was in elementary school, just lived like six blocks away from me. And if I ever acted up in school, she knew exactly where I lived. She could just simply stop by anytime and talk to my parents. And it's something to be said for seeing people like teachers shop at the same grocery store that you go to, or you see them, at the movie theater, you see them shopping, you just see them in your neighborhood. I think that builds community. And that's one thing that's missing from this entire argument, is if we want to change the conditions of a lot of things that are going on in the city, we have to think about community. What builds community? And I think having people live in a city that they serve helps to build community. I mean, it's nice to have a police officer on your block. It's nice to have a teacher, a public school teacher on your block. That helps build community. And I don't see anything wrong with that. If you want to live in West Dallas but work in the city, and you're a police officer, become a West Dallas police officer. I'm sure that they have positions open. But if it's a city job in Milwaukee, I think that should be reserved for people who live here.
We're talking right now with James Causey, columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel editorial board, talking about the reinstatement of Milwaukee's residency requirement. And James, as you know, Milwaukee grappling with some violence issues right now, some of the worst it's seen in recent years. And now for some people and prospective city employees, that could make Milwaukee a tougher sell. Wouldn't city jobs be more attractive and maybe attract the best talent if the candidates could live wherever they wanted?
Well, I mean, wait a second. That's where I struggle with. People say Milwaukee is violent. There's pockets of the city that are violent. On a whole, Milwaukee is not violent. I mean, a mayor, you know, where he doesn't live in the heart of the central city, but he lives on a pretty safe block. I mean, there are blocks in Milwaukee that are pretty unsafe, and we know what they need to fix these things. They need better community relationships with police officers. They need people from the mental health community working with these people who deal with trauma and things like that every day. They need jobs. They need a whole bunch of things. But all of Milwaukee is not unsafe, and I get upset when I hear people saying, well, it'll be a tough sale. No, it's not, because Milwaukee, where I live, is safe. I live right in the Sherman Park neighborhood. Is there problems over there? Some, but I don't. I go for walks every morning. I never feel like that I'm under siege or I'm about to get robbed or anything like that. So Milwaukee is relatively safe. Our downtown is safe.
Well, do you think Milwaukee would be safer with that residency requirement in place? Maybe with more of that community feeling.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you have police officers living in the city, well, yeah, why wouldn't it be safer? You're pretty much saying, I work here, I live here, and you're more vested. I believe you're more vested if you live in the city that you work in. I mean, why wouldn't you be? You'll be more vested in your block. You're more vested you have more input in things going on in your community when you live in it. When you don't live it, you're not as invested. You're vested in a place to where you live. I mean, that just seems like a no-brainer to me.
Now, you mentioned Detroit as an example that Mayor Barrett has held up as a cautionary example of what can happen when that residency requirement is taken away. Are there other cities that we can look to see how this has played out?
Well, yeah. I mean, I believe it was Indianapolis that had the same issue as well. I think Detroit was one of those kind of places. You pick Detroit when you want to talk about how bad things can get. Detroit had other problems. We know about the crash in the job market and all those other things. I just think residency was one of those things, like the final nail in the coffin to allow people to get out and flee the city. Will Milwaukee become like that if it reverses back? I don't know. But, you know, there are some people who say that it could probably happen that way in 10 years or so.
Now, you've said you don't think this is necessarily the end of the story. Where does it go from here?
That's a good question. I think it'd be a fight. I think Madison lawmakers will probably want to have a discussion on this matter. But I think this should be an issue for local jurisdictions. I don't think that this should come from Madison or anywhere else. I think local officials should make those decisions. I mean, I have a problem when Madison is trying to tell Milwaukee how to do things. I just don't think that's right. And this was an idea cooked up by Governor Walker, who believed that, you know, this would open up the doors and help fill some of the jobs that he said were hard to fill in this city. But I think that from a person who lives here, I think it would do the reverse and really take good paying taxpayers out of our city and put them out on the outskirts. And I don't know if that's a good idea. I just simply don't think it is.
James, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, no problem. You take care.
That was James Causey. He is a columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on the editorial board. He joined us to talk about the reinstatement of Milwaukee's residency requirement. Lindsey Graham is in need of a new phone number after Donald Trump gave out his personal cell number in front of national television cameras in South Carolina yesterday. The move, which he called, quote, fun, came after Graham said this on CBS.
I don't need a poll to tell Donald Trump it's not good to say that John McCain's a loser because he was captured in a time of war. It's not good to say that 11 million illegal immigrants are rapists and drug dealers when they're not. All I can say is that this is turning into a circus, and there comes a point in time.
And damaging the party.
Yeah, I don't care if he drops out. Stay in the race. Just stop being a jackass. Mm-hmm. You don't have to run for president and be the world's biggest jackass.
Time now for a weekly look at the latest in national politics. In other news, Ohio Governor John Kasich brought the number of official Republican candidates to 16 with his announcement yesterday. And GOP senators are calling for an investigation of Planned Parenthood after a second video of an employee discussing fetal tissue donation came out. Harry Enten joins us every week at this time. He's senior political writer and analyst for 538. Harry, good to have you back.
Great to be back.
Well, let's talk first about Donald Trump. His behavior, not usually what we see for presidential candidates in a major party. What's your take on the latest?
I mean, what is this? A student council election? I mean, this is what it literally feels like, where someone says something mean about you, so then you spread rumors about them and you give out their phone number on Facebook and you do all this. But instead of doing it on Facebook, you're doing it in front of a national television audience. I've never seen anything like this. I'm not sure anyone else has seen anything like this, because the normal rules of politics do not seem to apply to Donald Trump. If you're running in a Republican primary, you're not supposed to diss prisoners of war. And he did that. And did it affect his polling numbers? No, it doesn't seem to affect his polling numbers, because Donald Trump is simply just such a creature and so different than anything we've ever seen. It's bizarre, but it's also hilarious and great for television watchers, and people who normally aren't into politics love this type of stuff.
And you mentioned the polls, Harry. Donald Trump in some of the national polls, and of course there are no national primaries, they're all state by state, but he is leading in some of the latest national polls. Is this a Trump surge for real? Does this mean he has a real shot here?
I don't think it means he has a real shot. I mean, remember, we're only in July right now, and the first primaries aren't taking place until at least January. And over time, what we'll probably see is that people will see Trump for the unserious candidate that most people believe he is. But it is important that he is ahead in the national primary polls, because that's how we're going to determine who gets into the first few debates. And Trump right now is leading in the polling average, which guarantees that he'll be in front of a national television audience on August 6th for the first Fox News debate, while somebody who may be a more serious candidate by traditional standards, whether it be John Kasich or whether it be Rick Santorum, who was in second place last time around in 2012, will not make the debates because Trump is going to take their spot.
And I've seen some analysis saying not only might he take their spot, but by capturing all this media attention, social media attention, he's essentially stepping on efforts for those six candidates not hitting that threshold, not making the top 10, making it harder for them to do what they need to do in the last month or so to get into that debate.
That's exactly right. And if you look at somebody like Rick Perry, who has gone after Donald Trump very, very hard, he's recognizing that fact, and he's saying, I want to be part of this Trump media coverage. And so he's attacking Trump, and it has generated some media coverage for Perry. And right now, Perry is right on the precipice of being left out, but he's got that 10th spot. So it shouldn't be surprising if we see other candidates recognize that Trump is capturing all this media attention and go after him over the next few weeks in the lead up to the debate.
And you've looked at who is backing Trump, who is being polled that's into Trump. Donald Trump trying to make the case, hey, I've got a constituency, conservatives who agree with the things I'm saying within the Republican Party. When you crack the numbers, is that who the people are supporting him?
It's very interesting. Trump support is pretty much level across the party. So you look at moderates and liberals, you look at very conservative people, you look at people who say that they support the Tea Party, people who don't, college-educated, non-college-educated, and it turns out that Trump's percentages of the vote, when you average all of those polls, is pretty much the same, which to me suggests that this is really just more of a media boomlet. People are seeing his name a lot. They're interested in him. But once they start to realize that he isn't all that he's cracked up to be and some of the other candidates get attention, his numbers will come back down to earth.
Well, on to John Kasich, Ohio governor. He is in the race this week, announced yesterday. Is he going to add much to this primary? What kind of wrinkles does he bring that the other candidates don't?
Well, I think that Kasich adds a few wrinkles. Number one, look, if you're a Republican candidate running for president, you need to win the state of Ohio. And John Kasich is the governor of Ohio, and he won re-election last time with over 60% of the vote, including winning in the county that includes Cleveland, which is normally very, very Democratic. So Kasich brings this electability angle to him that certainly Republicans looking to beat Hillary Clinton will be very intrigued by. The problem, of course, is that being electable is only one facet. You also want to be seen as someone who could be the standard party bearer, someone who represents the conservative values of the Republican Party. And unfortunately for Kasich at this point, he's best known for Medicaid expansion under Obamacare, which is pretty much a death sentence among Republican primary voters. So what will be very interesting to see going forward is whether he can sort of shed this idea that he is too moderate for the Republican base and then combine it with that electability factor. But right now, there's pretty much no sign that he is going to be able to shed that moderate image and therefore probably won't go anywhere.
Right. You've written that politically he comes out, you know, moderate conservative end of the spectrum of candidates, but the perception of him puts him more on the moderate end.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, if you look at, remember, he was a 9-term congressman. He even had a show on Fox News for 6 years, and now he's been governor. You know, he's cut some taxes. So, you know, he has this sort of conservative image or moderate conservative, you know, if you look at it, an actual record, excuse me. But the image is he is somebody who will defend everything he does till his dying breath. And he will tell people who disagree with him, oh, you're stupid. He'll literally use that term. You don't know what you're talking about. He will talk down to people. And he's done that on the issue of Medicaid expansion. He told somebody that I care about poor people, which pretty much suggests that the other person didn't when they didn't want to have Medicaid expansion. And that's just not going to fly in a Republican primary.
We're looking at national politics with Harry Enten from 538. Turning to these Planned Parenthood videos, an undercover group released these videos after an interview with a Planned Parenthood official talking about fetal tissue donations. Apparently, it appears that nothing illegal was said or talked about there or didn't reveal illegal activity. But Republican senators are saying, hey, we need an investigation of this group. Maybe illegal, maybe unethical behavior. What are we hearing from Republicans in Congress and the presidential race about this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're starting to hear a lot more stuff about this where Republicans are coming out, especially Republicans in Congress, saying this is not okay. This is disgusting. These are their words, not mine. And this is a very smart play in my mind for Republicans, because if you look at the polling numbers, what you generally see is that most people are for abortion rights, at least most of the time. But they're not for it all of the time. And when you get down to nitty-gritty and you start talking about fetal parts and all of this, that, and other, it just most people don't want to hear about that. That's the sort of the ugly side of the abortion debate. So Republicans sense a political opportunity that they can exploit and say, you know what, most people, even if they're for, you know, they are pro-abortion, they're not that pro-abortion. So Republicans are going to try and make some hay out of this. We'll see if anything actually comes of it, because if there wasn't anything done that was actually illegal, and there's also some suggestion that these videos that were released were heavily edited, then it probably won't go anywhere. But Republicans, at least politically, have the right mind to at least try and exploit it, at least try and see what's going on.
And before we let you go, Harry, President Obama joined The Daily Show last night to bid farewell to Jon Stewart, both gradually on the way off of their respective jobs. The president joked he would release an executive order to keep Stewart at the show until the end of his term, at least. What significance do political satire shows like this have for the Democratic Party?
You know, if you look at The Daily Show's audience, it's overwhelmingly liberal. So I think it's something like 43% of The Daily Show's audience self-described as liberal. That's double than it is nationally. So this is a show that a lot of Democrats go on and a lot of liberal Democrats watch, and they get a good joke as Jon Stewart makes fun of Republicans. So this is, you know, the ending of an era, but of course there's always going to be a new era. There's going to be a new host of The Daily Show, and we'll see going forward whether or not it has the same impact. Who knows in this day and age where cable is shrinking as a percentage of what people watch.
And there's been talk that President Obama, after some wins in the Supreme Court and Congress, foreign policy, he's in the home stretch on his term, is loosening up, speaking out, feeling, looking more comfortable now. Do you see that?
Sure. I mean, you see that. You know, he'll come out and he'll say things that he might not otherwise say. Remember, he has no more elections to go. This is all going to be him going forward. There's nothing he can really lose. So, yeah, you know, Obama does seem to have what I would call more of a strut to him, to his step. Whether or not that can really affect anything with a Congress that's completely Republican, probably not. But at least he'll feel better about himself.
Harry, thanks as always.
Thank you.
That was Harry Enten. He's senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time to look at the latest news in national politics. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. In 2014, the Madison Metropolitan School District implemented a new behavior education plan aimed at trimming down the suspension rate out of school and giving kids more learning time in school. The move reflects a national trend to strip zero-tolerance policies from the books.
In Madison, out-of-school suspensions across the district dropped 32% in the first three quarters of the school year. But racial disparities went up, according to recent reporting, with African-American students getting 62% of all suspensions this year compared to 59% the previous year.
Micah Matthews is a former special education assistant in Madison's Tokie Middle School. He recently wrote a piece about the new policy, saying it leaves teachers busy handling behavior issues and results in schools that don't feel safe. He's with us in studio now. Micah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So why are you concerned with the discipline issues that you saw in Madison's Tokie Middle School that you feel reflect the district's new behavior education policy?
Mm-hmm. My concern is that while it sounds good on paper, in practice, it ends up making it feel like the students are in charge because there very often aren't real consequences for bad behavior. And so then teachers end up feeling powerless, and the adults in the building don't really seem to have any real control because the students know that they can kind of get away with stuff.
Now, you wrote that you felt that you had to kind of protect the kids that you were working with from behavior in the halls. Not that mm-hmm. other students were trying to attack them, but that the halls were unruly. Can you give us some examples of the kinds of behavior that you saw and that you're talking mm-hmm. about?
Yeah. So kids would quite frequently just skip class and run around the hallways. And so the hallways end up being chaotic. And kids are getting in fights. And when there's fighting going on, when it's a physically aggressive place like that, just being in the hallways is dangerous. I was working with a boy who was physically disabled and very fragile. And so just being around kids who were engaging in dangerous behavior, being very physically aggressive, just being around that is unsafe.
Now, you said the teachers you felt were not able to offer up real consequences when they confronted this sort of behavior. Mm-hmm. Why not?
It seems to me like while the teachers tend to know what's best for the students because they're the ones working with them, they don't have control. And it's like you can only carry as much weight as the ground beneath you will support, and the ground beneath you is the school's administration. The administration kind of decides how much control teachers will have over their classrooms. So if you're a teacher and a group of students decides to get out of their chairs and walk around and be disruptive, perhaps even begin fighting or something like that, or they're cursing at the teacher, there's just not much that the teacher can do.
Now, you spoke to some students at Tokie Middle School where you were a special education assistant, and they told you that they were worse, their behavior was worse mm-hmm. at school than it was outside of school.
Yeah.
What did they say?
These kids that I spoke to, like many of the students who were consistently engaging in bad behavior at Tokie, they were good-hearted. When you interacted with them, when you looked at their eyes, you could tell that they weren't bad kids. They were just, you know, doing whatever they could get away with. The problem, I think the fundamental problem with this approach to discipline is that there aren't clear boundaries. And I think middle school students, though they themselves are not aware of this, need boundaries in a school. And so, yeah, when I spoke to these kids, it was like, you know, they were choosing not to do their work, and they were being disrespectful to teachers and to me. And so I said, what are you going to do when you leave this place and you can no longer get away with behaving this way? And they said when they left it, they wouldn't act like that anymore because they knew they wouldn't be able to.
So let's see. Let's say a student is behaving outside the parameters. What would happen to that student who is unruly under this new policy?
Well, first, I think one of the first difficult factors is that at any moment in a school like Toki, there could be a lot of kids engaging in the same sort of disruptive or unsafe behavior. And so it's just about impossible to address everything. But then if behavior is addressed, for instance, a very common occurrence, if a student is upset about something or does not wish to do work or is fighting with a classmate, they might get up, throw something, and run out of the classroom. In which case, the teacher would pick up the phone and call what was called reflection, which was a cell phone that would either be carried by the security guard or the vice principal or some other member of staff who dealt with discipline. And if the call was answered, if that person wasn't already dealing with something else, they would try to find the student and then either bring that student right back to the class where the behavior would be repeated, or they would speak to the student about what they did. And I heard a few of those talks, and it tended to just kind of sound like a rehearsed lecture about, you know, being in control of your body and, taking charge of your education, you know, whatever, something that didn't mean much to the student. And so they knew that they could do this, and all they would have to do as a result is sit through a brief talk, you know.
We're talking right now with Micah Matthews, former special education assistant in the Madison Metropolitan School District. He's joining us to talk about his recent opinion piece in the Capital Times newspaper saying Madison Public Schools' new behavior education policy isn't working as he sees it. Now, proponents of this new plan say that this kind of plan, it takes more time because it's not simply removing the student from the environment and letting the school, the class continue without that student, but it's reincorporating them so that that student has a chance to learn and that investment is something that needs to happen to really give the kids a chance to change their behavior. What do you say to that?
I like the sound of that, and I think this approach to discipline is well-motivated, and I think it has a good heart. But when you actually see it in practice, while the theory is that it will keep kids in the classroom learning, what actually happens is that it creates chaos in the classrooms. And so nobody's learning. And the teachers are always dealing with behavior problems. And so they're not really able to teach. I think if something like this were to be successful, and I'm sure at some schools in the district it is, it would require outstanding leadership within the school itself. You would need the kind of principal who could communicate with kids just with his or her eyes. The kind of principal where the kids say, oh, you better stop, you know, they're watching us, right? That person doesn't exist at Toki. And so if this approach to discipline relies on communication with the students and, I don't know, mutual respect, you need someone in the building whom the kids respect in that way, you know?
The school district has said that they will be allocating more resources, it sounds like, in the coming years. Do you think that would help address some of the issues that you see here?
I don't think so. I have, you know, read emails, like district-wide emails that Superintendent Cheatham would send to the staff, and the tone of it, it usually sounded like, I mean, like, for instance, at the end of the school year, there was an email, and it was like, congratulations on a great year. You know, I've heard some people are upset about, you know, certain aspects of this policy. This is not verbatim. But, you know, we're going to put resources into, you know, training teachers and this and that. And it just seems not to actually be addressing the issue, which is that the teachers are quite powerless. And it's not a matter of how well trained the staff is. It's a matter of how much control the adults in the building have. Even the security guard has no more power than the teachers. And so when I say that it feels like the students are in control, it quite literally does feel that way.
And again, this sort of thing reflects a national trend to strip zero-tolerance policies from schools to lower the rate of out-of-school suspensions. Mm-hmm. How important is it to the service, the mandate of public schools to serve all children, to lower that rate of out-of-school suspenses? Is it a worthy goal?
Absolutely. I think it's incredibly noble to pursue that, and essential. And I absolutely agree with a policy that tries to decrease the number of expulsions, because we know that when a student is expelled, I mean, they might not be accepted into another school, and then it's just a downward spiral. But I think we need to address the behavior, right? So if we're looking at the numbers for this past school year, and the numbers tell us, well, this is working because there are fewer suspensions or fewer expulsions, that's not because the behavior was better. It's because the behavior wasn't really being addressed, you know.
Micah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Micah Matthews, a former special education assistant in the Madison Metropolitan School District. He joined us to talk about his recent opinion piece in the Capital Times, saying Madison Public Schools' new behavior education policy isn't working. We're talking now about how to handle behavioral issues in schools right now. Madison Public Schools have a new policy aimed at keeping kids in the classroom and away from out-of-school suspensions as much as possible.
And we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. How do you see issues of behavior and discipline carrying out in your local school district? As a parent, as a teacher, administrator, maybe as a student or recent graduate yourself, where do you draw the line between wanting to keep kids in the classroom as much as possible versus getting them out of that classroom if they're disrupting education for everyone else? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. Jerry is joining us from Northwest Illinois. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thank you. What do you think?
I'm just wanting to comment that I agree with the gentleman who wrote the piece in the Madison State Journal, Wisconsin State Journal. I come from a long, long career of being a behavioral interventionist in a major urban school system in the Midwest. But here's what's missing in regard to any of this discussion. The tolerance that we have in public schools for maladaptive behavior and inappropriate behavior in the classroom, tolerating screaming at the teacher, tolerating acting out, throwing objects at the teacher, use of obscene, provocative language, that translates when it's not challenged appropriately by school officials, that translates into behavior out in the community where we know that we have these inappropriate exchanges between police and young adults and teenagers. So that's something for people to be talking about.
And Jerry, let me just jump in and ask you, what about the argument that this approach takes more time? It's not a quick fix, removing an unruly student from a classroom. This is something that requires more investment, but it's maybe a worthy one.
Well, it's worthy when there is adequate support. But again, the gentleman you just interviewed indicated that clinically there needs to be a lot of support to implement a model like this. And very typically, in urban school systems, the support is lacking.
All right. Thank you so much for your call, Jerry.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We go now to Lori with us in Madison. Lori, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I think that the kids that aren't acting out in the classroom deserve the type of classroom and structure that they're in and deserve not to be disrupted by those that are acting out. And those that are acting out may be in need of a different structure. Maybe it's just not working for them, the type of situation that they're in. They should stay in school. But maybe they're not being offered like the hands-on type of learning opportunities that they need.
Lori, have you experienced this firsthand?
Yes, I am a retired special education teacher, and I think they're funneling funds into the same type of program that obviously isn't working.
Now, we've seen a backlash against zero-tolerance programs, Lori, where it was apparently too easy, some people said, to get kicked out of school, to get expelled from school. Do you think we had moved too far in that direction at some point, but maybe now overcorrecting?
Well, I just think, we're maintaining the same type of school structure. We are not doing anything different. We're just changing the behavioral approach. We're not changing the academic approach. Mm-hmm.
Lori, thanks a lot for sharing your perspective on that.
And we go next to Sarah in Watertown. Hello, Sarah.
Hi.
Hi, what is your take on this?
I'm an educator. I teach at a high school, but I've also taught at preschool level all the way through high school, and I believe that this is a great initiative. I think that if you're an educator that's able to create a positive environment, I think that it's better to have students in the classroom instead of alone at home or, not getting education within the classroom setting.
And is this the kind of approach that you would choose to take yourself?
Yes. For me, I'm a firm believer in building relationships with students. So I'm also lucky to live in a community that I have experienced support from. So with that, I feel like... when I create a positive environment, kids want to be in my classroom. So when they're acting out, it's a child. They're expressing some sort of stress, and I think it's appropriate to teach them how to respond to that stress instead of excluding them from an educational experience.
Sarah, appreciate that call.
We're taking your calls on behavior and discipline in Wisconsin classrooms. You can join in at 800-642-1234. There's been concern, maybe too many kids being suspended from school, maybe even expelled from school, an effort in some districts to keep them in the classroom, creating new concerns. Maybe that's creating disruption for all the other kids there. How do you think the lines should be drawn? What's your experience as a student, a teacher, a parent yourself? 800-642-1234 is the number. Nick joins us next in Madison. Nick, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm a middle school student at Thomas Jefferson Middle School in Madison. And I just wanted to say firsthand about how tough it is with the Lori experiences. It's pretty hard to learn. And with all these disrupting kids, And I really don't like this, the behavior education plan.
So, Nick, you see these students that might otherwise have been suspended or taken out of the classroom, staying in the classroom, making it hard for you and other students to learn?
Yes. And there was one incident in which probably a kid could have gotten expelled for it. He pushed a pregnant teacher just out of frustration. And he got a 3-day suspension, but it was really most people were in the school, mainly teachers and other staff. But some students were also saying that it should have been an expulsion automatically.
Nick, thanks for calling in and sharing your firsthand experience. Next, we go to Jenny in Deerfield. Jenny, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to speak from experience. I was in high school. And I did get suspended for a short period of time, and it did nothing for me. It did not teach me that I should be acting differently or doing anything differently. It just made me excited that I got to sit home and do whatever I wanted all day. And I think that's just a very outdated approach to dealing with students who need a different type of environment to learn and grow and be able to interact with society. If you take them out of that experience, they're never going to learn how to interact with their peers or authority figures or anything like that.
Jenny, thanks a lot for sharing your experience.
And thank you for all the calls. And remember, you can keep this conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page.
There has been a lot of hullabaloo and even some kerfluffle over a reported wildlife sighting in Milwaukee, as one resident called police to report seeing a lion.
That's right. Do not adjust your radio. A lion in Milwaukee, reportedly. Want to be very clear about that. There is a brief bit of blurry cell phone video. That sighting has not been confirmed, even after police searches and flyovers by news helicopters. But you and I, Rob, did look at the video online.
Yeah.
And it looks like...
It looks like a lion in a place.
In a place, which I suppose...
could be anywhere that has green lawns and shrubbery.
But it did look like a lion.
It did look like a lion. Now, people are thinking maybe mountain lion or cougar. They've been spotted in Wisconsin, way further north, nowhere near Milwaukee. Also, the zoo reports no missing lions. I guess that would have been my first guess.
Obviously, this has created, what did you say, Rob,
a kerfuffle
and the hullabaloo
both wrapped into one.
And as expected, there's even now a Milwaukee Lion Twitter feed. Photoshop pictures showing a photoshopped lion outside Miller Park. The lion seeing the sights, going to the domes and other landmarks.
One of my favorite things, apart from the Twitter feed, the lion reporting what he or she is up to around and responding to other people's tweets. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has kept running a picture of a lion with a disclaimer. This is not the lion that may or may not have been spotted in Milwaukee. So they're on top of it. They're not misleading us on this one. We'll go out with an eerily prophetic song from Katy Perry, the Nostradamus of our era. This is Central Time.